from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When juvenile crime is serious, American courts have been ready to send minors away for a long, long time. Life. Then the U.S. Supreme Court said, wait. Children, minors, deserve some chance at rehabilitation. The High Court said no to mandatory life sentences without parole for minors. But there is resistance. Many states are dragging their feet, finding other ways to throw away the key. This hour, On Point, states wrestling with redemption and how to handle this country's violent juvenile offenders. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. When the crime is bad, terrible, and the offender is young, where do you draw the line on imprisonment? Where would you hold open redemption? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Denver, Colorado, is Eric Eckholm, national legal correspondent for The New York Times. He's been reporting on states resisting the Supreme Court's push to limit juvenile sentences. You can find a link to his latest piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Eric, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
What was the fundamental message from the High Court here?
The fundamental message in a series of decisions has been that children are different. They're inherently less culpable. This is people who commit crimes under the age of 18. And first the court said they cannot be executed back in 2005. And then in two recent decisions that you can't have mandatory life sentences, and children should have some chance to rehabilitate. They didn't say that nobody could have a life sentence, but that in cases, in murder cases, you can give a life without parole sentence, but you first must look at the individual circumstances, any mitigating factors.
How big a change did this imagine? How much life without, mandatory life without parole sentencing has been going on in this country for juveniles?
Well, in the last few decades, there's been a real toughening of laws, putting more juveniles in adult courts, and for adults and juveniles, more mandatory sentencing. And more than 2,000 inmates in 2012 were serving mandatory life terms for crimes they committed under the age of 18. So the potential impact is fairly large for now and the future, depending on how states respond.
I mean, it is the law of the land with the Supreme Court decision, but you report advocates here saying states are going through the motions of compliance. How would a state do that?
Well, in Florida, for example, instead of life sentences, the courts have been giving some individual sentences of 70, 80, 90 years without parole, saying this is not life. They might live that long. And so defenders of these inmates have gone to court. It's now before the Florida Supreme Court. Is that actually a de facto life sentence? The other thing, it's more ambiguous legally. When the court decided in 2012 that those convicted of murder should not receive automatic mandatory life sentences, the court didn't make it clear whether this should be retroactive or not. So there are at least 2,000 people out there who received their sentences before June of 2012 who were left in a kind of limbo, and states have responded differently. In some cases, like California, they've said this will be retroactive and we will slowly go through the process of giving a new hearing to those inmates. But others, in Pennsylvania, which has the most prisoners, 450 who were given mandatory life sentences for murder, they said this will not be retroactive. So some people say that's deeply unfair and really goes against the spirit of the Supreme Court. If you were sentenced in May of 2012, and automatically, if you were found guilty of murder, you got a mandatory life without parole sentence. If you were sentenced 2 months later, you would not receive that.
The 2010 decision, Graham versus Florida, that said no sentences of life without parole for juveniles not convicted of murder, that one specifically applied. The Supreme Court said it applies to everybody previously sentenced. So they had to go back and resentence.
Yes, in that case, it was retroactive.
But in 2012, when they went to the murder circumstance, they didn't explicitly say resentence. Did they explain the difference in thinking?
They didn't, and it's led to, there are some sort of technical legal reasons, the way it was phrased, that it leaves it open to the interpretation that it would not be retroactive. And states have interpreted this differently, and you have different states with different findings, and you have, even within states, contradictory findings. So many people think the Supreme Court is going to have to revisit this at some point.
Of the 50 states at this point, Eric, how many are or are not lining up with the spirit of the law in their sentencing? How many are or are not resentencing those under the new guidance?
I can't give you an exact count. Most of the states, well, first of all, a lot of states have not had the practice of mandatory life without parole for juveniles. But among the states with larger numbers, I think it goes kind of 50-50. And in others, it's still before the courts. This is still a very fresh and raw issue. Just in the last few weeks, the Supreme Court in Illinois, just last week, the Supreme Court in Illinois took up the issue, and it's before the Supreme Courts in Florida and the state of Washington. Just a couple of weeks ago, Massachusetts decided that it will make it retroactive. So it's a very current and live issue.
Pennsylvania, with more than 450, as you report, serving automatic life sentences for murder when they were juveniles. Louisiana, 230 inmates in that status. Florida, with 198. What's the core philosophical argument here? Or is it philosophical? Is it a matter of biology and brain development? Is this about their souls or about whether or not they were capable as juveniles of understanding their offense or whether they're capable of growing into different people?
Yes, well, the Supreme Court clearly accepted the growing scientific argument that their brains are not fully developed and their judgment is not fully developed in the teenage years. But then there are others who feel, so there is a scientific argument, but in the end there's some philosophy and basic political beliefs there too, and some people just feel if a crime is so horrible, and especially the older juveniles, like 16, 17, that there's no reason they shouldn't be treated the same as any adult. And the other argument against reopening old cases that's made by victim groups is that, look, we thought we had closure, and to drag the family back into a new parole hearing or something when they thought this guy was put away for life is not fair to them.
Eric Eckholm with the New York Times has raised this very clearly, given us the national picture. Eric, we appreciate your reporting, and thanks for joining us from Denver today.
Thank you.
The crimes that raise these issues can be terrible, revisiting tough sentences hard. In 1995, 15-year-old Edward O'Brien brutally murdered his family's neighbor, Janet Downing, in Somerville, Massachusetts. In 1997, he was sentenced to life without parole on Christmas Eve. Just a month ago, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that all past life without parole sentences for juveniles would be reconsidered, resentenced, including O'Brien's. Janet Downing's son, Paul, is with us now. Paul Downing, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think of this ruling that would mean a reconsideration of the life without parole sentence of your mother's murderer, Edward O'Brien?
It's definitely reopening a wound for the entire family. It's a very scary thought that this person possibly could be among us again. It's not going very well with a lot of us. A lot of people who supported us.
It was a terrible murder. You were neighbors. His grandfather had been chief of police in your town, Somerville. He was only 15. Mm-hmm. He's a big boy, 6'4", 250 pounds, 260.
Yep.
But even for all that, he was only 15. I mean, is it a matter of justice, vengeance? What, Paul, that he should be in prison for the rest of his life? When you think about this case, do you think, well, maybe he'll change over 20, 30, 40, 50 years?
There's nothing to excuse what he did. I mean, my mother suffered over 90 stab wounds, and it was an extreme, atrocious act to someone he knew very closely. Whether his brain was developed or not at that point, he knew right from wrong. And there's nothing that could justify what he did. There's just nothing that can excuse it.
Have you heard exactly what might happen now, what will happen with the Massachusetts High Court's ruling?
We're kind of in limbo. Our family won't know more until about June, I would say. where he may be up for parole at that time. So yes, he has the ability to appeal his case, and who knows where he may go with the direction of how he's going to get himself out. And the thought of that just it's really terrifying.
Resentencing means getting back into all of that, and it was clearly terrible. But what about? I mean, you're older now. He's older now.
Mm-hmm.
What about someday when he's 50 years old, when he's 60, when he's 70 years old, but maybe even 80 years old? Is there any point at which you might think, well, it was terrible, but that's a lot of time? Let's say enough.
If I can get my mother back, then maybe I'd say, you know, it's okay. But I'm sorry, a life was taken. A person is never going to exist again. Someone, my mom will never be alive. So fair is fair. You did what you did, and you get to live still. Don't forget that.
Paul Downing, we appreciate your sharing your perspective on this with us today. I want to thank you very much for being with us for a few minutes here. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about states wrestling with life sentences for juvenile offenders. The Supreme Court has said no mandatory life without parole. More than a dozen states are pushing back. It gets into some deep judicial and philosophical issues about human nature, crime, punishment. With us right now from Washington is Jody Kent Levy, Director and National Coordinator for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. Jody Kent Levy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, David Freed is here. He's district attorney of Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. Includes the city of Carlisle, part of the suburbs of Harrisburg. He's president of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. Pennsylvania has over 450 of the roughly 2,500 inmates serving life without parole sentences for crimes committed as juveniles, the most of any U.S. jurisdiction. David Freed, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Jody, first to you. The court has ruled on this, but we see states in many ways, quite a few states, dragging their heels. What do you see going on that by your lights, and you're an advocate for reconsidering and room for redemption, that by your lights is not in keeping with the spirit, maybe the letter of the court's ruling?
Sure, Tom. I mean, the campaign seeks to implement age-appropriate alternatives to life without parole sentences for children, and that's what, you know, the Supreme Court has said now three times is necessary. You know, in the 90s, states just went too far in implementing policies that allow children to be tried as adults and allow these extreme sentences to be imposed on them. And now the United States alone sentences our children to this most extreme sentence, which ignores the unique characteristics of children, defies science and common sense, and criminologists agree that these sentences are not appropriate for children. And while there has been some resistance, there's also been incredible momentum building to scale back these extreme sentences and implement age-appropriate alternatives. There's growing bodies of adolescent development research, the medical community, adolescent development experts, as well as child welfare groups such as the Boy Scouts of America, the Parent Teachers Association, and even corrections organizations all agree that we've gone too far, and it's important for us to revisit these policies and ensure that children are held accountable for their acts. And, you know, children can and do commit serious crimes, and the results are really no less tragic than when adults commit these crimes. But without question, we need to ensure that they're held accountable in a way that reflects their unique characteristics as children and check in on them later in life. And that's what we're advocating for.
David Freed, Pennsylvania has more inmates serving life without parole sentences for crimes committed as juveniles than any other state in the country. What, 450, that's a lot. What has driven those numbers so high, David?
Well, it's important to remember that the juveniles doing life in Pennsylvania are all people who were adjudicated or convicted of first-degree murder and second-degree murder. First-degree murder in Pennsylvania is premeditated murder characterized by specific intent. Second-degree murder in Pennsylvania is felony murder, but it's reserved for very serious felonies. So a murder committed during a felony such as forcible rape, arson, robbery, burglary, and kidnapping. It's also important to remember that, Pennsylvania has a process in place to move appropriate cases back to juvenile court if a judge believes that's appropriate. I think there's a lot of factors, Tom, that go into our numbers. I think one important factor is a particularly violent time in an urban center. That's Philadelphia, a city that has really turned the corner in terms of gun violence, especially last year in terms of their murder rate. But it is a combination of the extreme level of violence going on at the time that these sentences became available.
So how has Pennsylvania responded to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on this, David? I assume you are no longer handing down mandatory life sentences without parole. That's out. What about resentencing?
Sure. We've put into place, the legislature has put into place a new sentencing process in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I read Mr. Eckholm's article, I think, on Sunday when it appeared on the website. And really, that article does a great job of laying out how different things are being handled around the country. Pennsylvania's new scheme now provides certain mandatory minimum sentences for first-degree murder. If an offender is between 15 and 18, the mandatory minimum is 35 years. For those ages, if it's second degree, the mandatory minimum is 30 years. Under 15 for a first-degree murder, 25-year mandatory minimum. Second degree, a 20-year mandatory minimum with a tail or an end of the sentence of life. And then life without parole is still a possibility. The statute also lays out numerous factors that a judge has to consider. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled that the U.S. Supreme Court decision is not retroactive in Pennsylvania, so we have a new sentencing scheme going forward. But as was indicated earlier, because there have been some rulings in some states where it's been found to be retroactive, somewhere it hasn't, I think those of us involved all expect this to be decided ultimately by the United States Supreme Court.
Jody, I want to ask about both the way Pennsylvania is responding there and about this issue of whether it should be applied retroactively. The court was clear on that in 2010. With non-murder cases. In 2012, it was not so clear, and states are treating that in different ways. Are you pushing for resentencing, retroactive application of this ruling, Jody, for all juvenile offenders in this situation? And what's the argument for that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. We believe that just in basic fairness, it's essential that the Miller decision be applied retroactively.
This is Miller versus Alabama, the 2012 decision on murder.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And as Eric stated earlier, there are certainly concerns about, you know, people who were sentenced in May of 2012. I think it's and the fact that it's possible that Miller wouldn't apply to them. I mean, the reality is
a month
this
later
decision,
it would have applied, and you say, where's the justice there? Where's the fairness?
Exactly. I mean, we've learned a great deal since many of these policies were enacted, particularly in the 90s. At the time when the super predator theory was at its height and people believed that there was going to be this juvenile crime wave, which criminologists predicted, and it led to a lot of these tough on crime policies that now exist and allow children to be sentenced to die in prison. And since then, we've learned that theory was actually disproven, and criminologists have come out and said that it's inappropriate for us to sentence our kids to life without parole, and it isn't serving any penological purpose. And so given that, I mean, we've learned a great deal about adolescent development research since then as well. I mean, any parent knows that a teen is a very different individual than when they grow up and are, decades later, their character is fully formed. And so I think we have to take what we've learned and apply it in order to update, you know, our justice system and allow for fairness in our justice system going forward. And that's really what the Supreme Court has done in issuing its decision in Miller v. Alabama. And so to say that people sentenced before June 25th, 2012 should not have access to what we've learned and to this new, fairer system is simply unjust. In addition to that, you know, the court also had a companion case that was sitting alongside the was heard alongside the Miller v. Alabama case, and that was the case of Contrell Jackson, who was also 14 years old at the time of his crime. And The court applied the Miller decision to Cuntrell Jackson's case, implying that they did intend for it to be retroactive. Now, as Dave noted, this is likely to ultimately to be decided by the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. But from our perspective, it certainly does need to apply to those currently serving.
Jody, David Fried, I've got a lot more questions for each of you, but our listeners have many comments and questions here as well. Let me go to Sean, calling from Groveland, Massachusetts. Sean, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. I'm actually the brother to Beth Brody, who was murdered in 1992 by a juvenile who was sentenced in 1994 to the harshest penalty that could be applied to him, which was life in prison without parole.
How old was she? How old was he? What happened, Sean? Remind us. It's a long time ago now.
She was 15. He was 16. And she did not pursue a romantic relationship with him, and he took offense to that. Throughout the course of a day in conversations with a mutual friend, he drove to the home of the mutual friend carrying a baseball bat and lured her to the home and then bludgeoned her to death.
We will remain always sorry for that whole story. How are you thinking about the Supreme Court ruling now, Sean, and what ought to happen with the killer of your sister?
Well, what the family cannot understand is the retroactivity behind this, and I've heard the arguments in the last few minutes about it. But had the state still abided by death sentence laws, what would we do then? You know, how far back do you go, and where do you draw that line to bring this back up and strip victims' families of any right or any solace that they may have found since it happened is just tragic, and it's not right. The cruel and unusual punishment here is to victims and their families, not to these convicts.
It's an absolutely heinous crime. There's no question about it. But what about the notion of redemption over time, Sean? I mean, this was a 16, your sister was 15, she deserved to live. This was a 16-year-old boy who did a terrible thing. But what about the idea that over many years, A, there's punishment, and B, you know, the human brain, the human character is not fully developed at 16. There's room for redemption. How do you think about that, Sean?
Well, her brain wasn't fully developed either, if this is the argument. But yet she knew the difference between right and wrong. She didn't do anything wrong. She was a saint. She recognized that this was not somebody I want to have a romantic relationship with. So in his eyes, the proper thing to do here is take somebody's life. That's just simply not fair. So why should he experience any of the rights and freedoms that she could have used up to this point?
Jody Kent-Levy, what do you say to Sean? It was his sister. She was 15 years old. The murderer was 16. And he says, you know, why should the family pay the price of going through the resentencing process alongside the killer at this point? What do you say to Sean's argument, Jody?
I mean, first of all, I just want to say, Sean, you know, my heart goes out to you. I think we can all agree that none of us want to see violence like this occurring in our communities, and all of us need to be putting more effort towards prevention and ensuring that these violent acts never occur to begin with. We at the campaign work with a number of victims' families who have been have lost loved ones to violence. And I know that the victims' perspectives on this are incredibly important, and they're also incredibly varied. There's no one perspective. There are victims' families that we work with who have met the individuals who have killed their loved ones, have gone into prison and done restorative justice programs with them, and have since been on the outside advocating for these individuals to have a second chance. And for them, the Supreme Court decision gives them hope. And I know that isn't the case for everyone. I think this is a very nuanced and complex issue. But I think it's important to shed light on all the different kinds of perspectives that exist, because they really are varied.
Sean, do you know what process is now underway? The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court has ruled on this, so presumably resentencing will come to this case. Do you have a sense of how that will unfold, Sean?
We're actually preparing for the parole now, preparing with District Attorney Blodgett, and he's been very proactive in this, and he's been very supportive. He's got probably the best attorneys from his office working on our parole hearing. But it's just unfortunate that, you know, my family is going to spend the rest of our lives preparing for these, because even if he is denied parole in this first hearing, he's going to be up for parole in whatever the court sees is fair, whether it's 3 or 5 or even 10 years.
Yeah.
We're constantly preparing for this parole. I think the argument here should be, it should be left open to the judges in these cases to leave, take the mandatory out, but leave it as an option. In some cases, these guys do need to go away without an option of parole.
Sean, I appreciate your call. Sean's sister, Beth Brody, killed in 1992, 15 years old by a 16-year-old. And now this is all back with the Supreme Court ruling. Sean, thank you very much for calling. David Fried, what about resentencing? And the complaint here is that people say, let's have a chance for redemption. On the other side, that it's traumatic for the families of victims.
Right. I think everybody has to remember. Certainly, Jody does an effective job of advocating her position, and there are advocates on the other side. And we as prosecutors and my colleague in Massachusetts that was mentioned by the last caller and prosecutors in Pennsylvania, we're sworn to protect the public. And our responsibility is to do justice as we see it. The toughest issue in my experience with the victims that we deal with is the finality. They want to know that there's some finality inherent in the system, and when cases are reopened time and time and time again, that's a real struggle for victims' families. And you know, we as prosecutors can never make the case better than someone who's lost a loved one, and we've heard from two of those people today. As it relates to the United States Supreme Court case, you know, I certainly believe that there was an opportunity there to directly address retroactivity, and the court chose not to take that opportunity, and they've done that in the past. So I do think it's an issue that's up in the air. Certainly, I think society and the criminal justice system has come a long way in trying to understand the juvenile mind, trying to understand juvenile criminals and trying to treat them. But let's not forget, at least as it relates to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we're talking about the most serious crimes, and those are the crimes that that lead to these sentences.
Oh, boy. Tough situation. Jody, are you sympathetic when Sean says his family doesn't want to go through parole hearings every X number of years for the rest of their lives for their sister, daughter's killer?
Absolutely. And I do know that there are programs in place to support victims. Frankly, we believe that they should be better funded, and they do need to have better supports in place to victims' families. Going through the trials and the parole processes are, you know, I can only imagine. I know we're going to hear from another victim family later on, and I'll let her speak directly to this issue, because I can't speak on behalf of a victim family member directly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about states wrestling with life sentences for juvenile offenders after the Supreme Court has said no mandatory life without parole. A lot of states are pushing back on this, finding ways to drag their feet. Okay, no life without parole, but it's a 70-year sentence, or 80 or 90 amounts to the same thing. The court was a little unclear on whether or not there should be resentencing for the 2,000-plus already in prison in this country under these terms, and states having different responses to that. California, resentencing. Massachusetts, the High Court has said resentence. Others, there again, not so clear. Jody Kent Levy is with us from the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, joins us from Washington. She's director and national coordinator there. David Fried is with us, district attorney of Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, where this is a big issue. He's president of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. Dave Fried, here's a comment from a listener on Twitter who says, "What was the point of establishing juvenile courts or setting the age of majority at 18 if we're just going to treat these young offenders as adults?" Dave?
That's an excellent question, Tom. The juvenile system, especially in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, is focused on treating the offender as opposed to conviction and sentence. And in the county where I'm the district attorney, I personally review every juvenile petition to see if there's a way we can divert the case. Can we deal with the family? Can we get this child into treatment to make sure that they don't return into the system? You know, that should be our goal. What's happened, and certainly happened in the 90s, was as criminals became younger and more violent, there were reactions legislatively to that sort of behavior and a lot of push to get violent offenses into adult court. In Pennsylvania, we have a system that allows in certain circumstances juveniles to be tried as adults for serious violent crimes where weapons are involved. So I think that we haven't taken away from the entire purpose of juvenile court, especially by treating serious crimes. And in Pennsylvania, we're talking about first and second degree murder, treating those juveniles as adults. And I want to make the point again that we have a process in place in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania where the advocates for the juveniles can make a presentation to the court. There's a hearing in place, factors the judge has to consider, and the judge can move the case back to juvenile court. There's a case out in the western part of Pennsylvania, Lawrence County, just above Pittsburgh, that was ultimately prosecuted by the Attorney General's office in Pennsylvania very recently, where that happened. It was a very young boy. He may have been 11 or 12, and shot and killed a woman. And it started out as an adult, and he was moved back to juvenile court. So I've seen the process work in terms especially of the younger juveniles. When we get into the 17 and 18-year-olds, I think it becomes more difficult to move those cases back to juvenile court, and appropriately so.
Let me go to Caitlin in Hanover, New Hampshire. Caitlin, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your guests could comment at all on how the states are viewing the goals of prison. Is it meant to be punitive, or is it meant to be a rehabilitation? And is that influencing how they're making these decisions?
That's a great question, Caitlin. What about this country's, or state by state, Jody, the fundamental outlook on imprisonment and its point? Punitive or restorative?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I think it actually goes back to the comment that David just made about, and I guess the prior caller made about the juvenile justice system, which was really meant to focus on rehabilitation for children, because we know that young people are uniquely capable of change and that they respond well to rehabilitative programs, which is really the point and should be the point when we're talking about how to hold young people accountable. Unfortunately, these adult sentences, transferring young people into the adult system, rarely accounts for the unique characteristics of children and really focuses on retribution and really just warehousing individuals for long periods of time, which comes with a huge cost, an economic cost as well as a human cost. And that's why criminologists and corrections officials have come out and opposed these kinds of sentences. You know, there are corrections leaders across the country who are saying, we see these children grow up in our adult prisons. This isn't the place for them. And that is why we have a juvenile justice system that's uniquely created to cater to the needs of these young people who have been led astray. And I think that, you know, it's incredibly important to focus on that and frankly, the implementation of these adult sentences on children. They are not always reserved for the most serious crimes. More than half of the people sentenced to life without parole for crimes committed as youth were first-time offenders. A quarter of them were convicted of felony murder. There are gross racial disparities in the implementation of this practice. Black youth are sentenced to life without parole at a per capita rate that is 10 times that of white youth. And it's arbitrary regionally when you look at how these sentences are imposed. Pennsylvania leads the nation in this practice with nearly 500 people serving the sentence, and two-thirds of the people serving this sentence are concentrated in only five states. So I think we really need to take a close look at how these adult sentences are being imposed, and it raises real questions about whether it's actually being done for public safety purposes. And we would argue that it's not, and criminologists and corrections officials and the law enforcement community, frankly, are moving in that direction and recognizing that we've gone too far.
You talk about children led astray. Of course, not everybody buys that. Here's a listener says there's just something bad wrong with today's youth. Now, in every generation, we seem to hear that. But on the other hand, we've got some pretty violent crimes. On the third hand, if that third hand is out there, we've got some tough circumstances in which some people are growing up. Jake in Des Moines, Iowa. Jake, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yeah, well, a couple points I want to touch on. The age-appropriate mandatory minimum that were being talked about in, I think it was Massachusetts, something like that, it seems totally appropriate. But to think that these kids of 15 and older, these children committing these murders and stabbing other people excessive numbers of times, they know right from wrong. And there's no way around that. If there's a mental issue, then, you know, there's avenues to deal with that. And
well, I mean, you say they do, but some of them are so young. I mean, we're hearing, you know, 14, 13, 12 here. Maybe they don't completely know right from wrong, at that age.
I knew right from wrong when I was probably 7, 8 years old. I did something I knew I was going to get in trouble for. I'd turn and run for my dad because I knew I was going to get in trouble.
Well, okay, what about the idea of redemption? Let's say they blow it. They miss it. They don't get it at that age. What about later, decades later?
I can see where, you know, 20 years down the line or so, like I said, 15 and above, what was it, 25-year mandatory minimum, that sounds appropriate.
Some kind of limit, maybe. Jake, our time begins to grow short, but I appreciate your call in Des Moines, New Orleans. Parisa's calling. Parisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I am a physician in residency training in the field of neurology.
Okay.
And even though this is a very complex issue at hand, I wanted to mention an instance where I felt the neuroscience did not really match the ethics of crime and punishment. I don't have a reference, but I remember reading a study that showed that men's brain reached the halfway point of maturity at age 15, suggesting their brain don't really reach adult maturity until age 30, whereas women's brain reached the halfway point of maturity at 11 and a half to 12. Suggesting they mature to adult brain at 23 or 24.
So just take the males, Parisa. If a male's brain is 50% matured at age 15, but there's a murder, how would that affect
But I don't think it would not be fair to incriminate a woman at 25 more severely than a man at 25. So actually, I think this is an instance where the neurology, the neuroscience, does not really match up to the ethics at hand. So I don't think you could really take the science and directly apply it to the actual sentencing process.
Boy, that's interesting. Take the difference between the genders, and you began to wonder about the whole idea of using these scientific measures of maturation to bring to bear on sentencing. On the other hand, we're talking about redemption here. We're not talking about walking off scot-free. It gets very subtle. It gets very interesting here. Jody Kent Levy, David Fried, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Chicago, Jean Bishop. Her sister, Nancy, and her brother-in-law, Richard, were murdered in 1990 by a 16-year-old. Her sister, Nancy, was pregnant with the couple's first child when she died. That young man was sentenced to life without parole in 1991. Jean has spent over 20 years since. She is as a public defender in the Cook County, Illinois, includes Chicago. Her own thinking on this has evolved over the years. Jean, thank you very much for being with us today. Do you support the Supreme Court, Jean, in saying let's leave open a chance for redemption or not?
I do support that, Tom, and I do because I believe that any kind of mandatory sentence for any human being, adult or juvenile, ignores the unique circumstances of the facts of the case, of that, the characteristics of that person. I just don't think we can take a cookie-cutter approach. And I also have to say, in my own case, the young man who killed my family members received a mandatory sentence for killing my sister and her husband, mm-hmm. but he received a discretionary life sentence for killing their unborn child. With respect to the mandatory sentence, my family was not even allowed to do a victim impact statement at sentencing because there was no aggravation and mitigation proceedings. There was no possibility of us to have any input at all into the sentence.
Jean, how has your attitude about that sentence evolved over the years, if it has? Were you satisfied at the beginning? Were you happy to see him put away for life, mandatory? If it's changed, why? How?
When he was sentenced, my mother turned to me in the courtroom and said, "We'll never see him again." And I was glad of that. I wiped him off my hands like dirt. And over the years, having worked as a public defender and seeing the clients that I have up close and seeing my own thinking on so many things evolve, and then having children, young men, boys of my own, I started to realize that this sentence is merciless, that it freezes in time forever something that someone did at a very young age, and that people do have the capacity for remorse to rethink what they're doing. And certainly that's true in the case of the person who took my sister's life. He started out remorseless, denying the crime, took the stand, blamed it on someone else. But when I got in touch with him, now that he is age 40, he wrote me a 15-page letter apologizing, confessing to the crime, and kind of tracing the arc of his thinking on his crime.
Jean, let me put you in touch with one of our callers here, Kevin, in West Hartford, Connecticut. Kevin, you're on the air. What do you think about all this?
Yeah, you know, one of the problems I have with it is we have laws in society. We a lot of times we almost make excuses. I understand there's circumstances where some kids grow up in bad environments or they're being abused and they murder. But I think we're losing sight of what the system is supposed to do. It's supposed to be, first of all, when you have a system like that, it's supposed to make people think. And what we're doing now is we're softening the laws in such a way, even for Connecticut death penalty, even for the kids putting a limit on how long they can be incarcerated, and we're taking the fear factor out of our system.
You don't think 20, 30, 40 years in prison is enough to make even a young person think, if they're going to think at all, Kevin?
What about the person they killed? The family's going to live with that forever.
Yeah,
I think there comes a point where we got to be more concerned about the victims than the person that commits the crime, because a lot of the kids that do the wrong, they know right from wrong.
But still, 20 or 30 years in prison for a young person, that can't mean nothing if they think about it at all. But Jean, what do you think of Kevin's observation here?
I think that it's that he's pointing out something valuable, which is that we do want incarceration not only to incapacitate people who are dangerous, but we also want it to make them think and reflect. The problem is, though, that if you have a sentence that says never, we're going to lock you up and you will never, ever have a parole hearing or any sort of review of the sentence. You will die in a coffin, die in prison and come out in a coffin. Mm-hmm. If you do that, then the whole process of them thinking and reflecting and becoming remorseful, you know, is almost purposeless. I mean, if they are people who can safely be restored to society and be productive and do something to honor the lives of the victims, the lives that they took, that would be, I think, a good thing. Not everyone is going to be able to do that. There are some people that, you know, may never reach that point, but I think that everybody has the capacity to do that.
We've got other listeners with different perspectives. Sanjay is saying, you know, not everybody wants to be harsh forever here, talking about victims' parents actually trying to get the killer out of jail. We've got Tegan asking this question. Do our prisons actually rehabilitate? So are they doing the work even with young people in there? Jody Kent Levy, I'll put it to you. So that after decades, has this redemption work been done? Or are they just sitting in, you know, cages with a lot of other criminals killing time?
Sure. I mean, too often there are not adequate programs available, but that doesn't mean that people don't change. I mean, we work with a number of remarkable individuals who were convicted of serious crimes as teens and have turned their lives around and are now mentoring at-risk youth in the communities. And I think that that's really the thrust of this is, you know, do we as a society, how do we want to deal with our children when they make grave mistakes? I mean, do we want to just rid ourselves of a responsibility for them the day they commit a crime and discard them for the rest of their lives? Or do we want to make sure that we hold them accountable for the harm that they've caused in a way that that ensures that they learn from their mistakes, that they better themselves, and maybe one day return to their communities? I mean, what we're advocating here is checking in on them later in life. Charles Manson has come up for parole 12 times, and some of these young people never will. And so the question is, giving them a bit of hope, something to work toward, a reason to prove that they can improve themselves and fulfill their potential. That's what we're advocating for, and what, you know, the Supreme Court has said is really necessary given the fundamental differences between kids and adults.
David Fried, can we deter young people from these terrible crimes without mandatory life, without parole, as a threat out there?
From my perspective, I think it's a very difficult thing. The more serious the crime, sometimes we just have to lock them up, Tom.
Boy, it's a lot of people for a long time, and it gets down, Jean Bishop, to this notion of whether you believe in redemption. I guess you do, Jean.
Yes, I do. I think that everyone, if we're honest and look into our own hearts, realize that we are in need of that. We would want that for our own children. If they messed up in some way and were sorry and were rehabilitated, we wouldn't want them to die in prison.
Jean Bishop, her sister and brother-in-law were murdered in 1990. She's come around on this question. Jean, thank you for joining us today from Chicago.
Thank you.
District Attorney David Freed in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. Dave, thank you.
Tom, thank you for a very fair treatment of this tough issue.
And Jody Kent Levy with the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth. Thanks for joining us, Jody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.